What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
The new Wegovy pill is now available through Weight Watchers. Powerful GLP-1 results in a simple pill at the lowest price available. And with Weight Watchers, you can get doctor support and personalized nutrition programs. See if you qualify at WeightWatchers.com. Ad not reviewed or approved by Novo Nordisk.
Make sure you become Patreon supporters of The Katie Helper Show, because this week's Patreon-only episode is an interview I did with Rose McGowan, never before released on video or in audio. It is from last April, but it's still extremely relevant. So again, patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including an alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows. Welcome to The Katie Helper Show. So happy to be here. I'm, of course, your host, Katie Helper. Very excited about our guest, who I will introduce shortly. But I want to just take a moment to, of course, say hi to Leslie Lee.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, you?
Good, good. I'm good. Happy to be here on a Wednesday night, though this is interfering with my housewives time. So,
what's housewives time?
Oh, Real Housewives of Beverly Hills.
Well, yeah. I want to thank you for your contribution, depriving yourself of that and giving yourself to this.
It's a wonderful show. You learn so much about the human condition from it. It's quite fascinating.
I think I like the New Jersey. I never watched it, but is the New Jersey ones where they have these really ridiculous like Roman columns in front of the house?
I think that might be two or three of them, but that does sound like New Jersey.
Oh, well. Right. That would make sense. Yeah. And their names are like was it Melania? Now that I know who Melania Trump is, I feel like maybe when I watched it, I didn't know any other Melanias, so it didn't stand out that much. Obviously not named after Melania Trump, but Melania or something.
Oh, you get some interesting names.
Yeah.
On the Lesser Housewives show, especially. Real Beverly Hills, that's like the real deal of the stars.
Got
real
it.
Real rich people, but, you know, a little bit more flavor on the other ones.
Where's Nate? Is Nene her name? Is there a Nene?
Probably. I only really know Beverly Hills. I only really
mess with Beverly Hills. I think she may be Atlanta, this person I'm thinking of. Anyway. Well, we have a great show for you guys today. You know, it's important. We really wanted to make sure. Let's have a moment of silence, by the way. Okay. A moment of silence just passed for Colin Powell, RIP, no longer with us. And Leslie was actually just devastated about it.
And I was devastated. The only thing that devastated me was seeing Public Enemy doing an RIP Colin Powell tweet.
Yeah, what was that?
I thought the corniest thing about Public Enemy was when white people started getting really into them in the OOs, but this is a new low for them, actually.
A new low. Even worse.
Yes.
You didn't think it could be, it was possible.
I mean, because Colin Powell, I remember this cat from when I was a kid, because he was sold to me as, you know, first of all, I didn't even really know he was black because he's so light-skinned. And he is hanging out with the Republicans and other black people did. So I didn't even really know he was black. When I first, like the first few times I heard of him, it didn't even click in my head that he was black. You know, I knew he was something. I didn't know he was black, but even then, like, so what? Like, he's a black guy who did what? You know what I mean? Like,
well, we're going to get into that.
I guess we will, but man, just an awful person that people were so enamored with for some reason, thought they saw such Dick T and courage in him when really he was like a coward, one of the most cowardly people that's ever lived in history.
Do you remember when you realized he was black?
No, not really. Not really. It was been young.
Yeah, my cousin's kid, who's now a freshman in college, I remember was really surprised when he learned that Michael Jackson, I mean, this is very different, but he didn't know that Michael Jackson was black.
A lot of people pretended like he wasn't in his later days, but yes.
Yeah.
Much to his consternation.
Well, should we just bring in our guests? I'm really excited to bring in our guests. And there's Colin Powell, in case anyone forgot who we were talking about. A lot of people writing Colin Powell, good riddance. But Leslie really wanted to make sure we honored him. And I figured out that a great way to honor him would be by having a guest on who has a different view from the view that we're seeing in the media. You know, people ranging from Public Enemy to Jamal Bowman, even, which was kind of surprising. Squad member Jamal Bowman praising him. And so we have a journalist and filmmaker. He writes for places like The Independent, Guardian, Vice, Foreign Policy, NBC, and more. You can find out more about him at Ahmed Twaij, and that is at AhmedTwaij. You can also follow him on Twitter at TwaiJi. So please welcome journalist Ahmed Twaij. Hello, how are you?
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Good, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks.
And Ahmed is a very prolific journalist, and you're going to tell us more about your life because you did not start off as a journalist, but you have tons of recent pieces. And we're going to talk firstly, though, about your piece on Colin Powell, which is called "As an Iraqi, I'd Sooner Mourn My Country Than Treat Colin Powell as a Hero." So I guess tell us why you wrote that piece, but also tell us about your own life, because I think those two things are obviously related.
Sure. I assume you want to hear about my life first.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm born and raised in the UK. My parents are originally Iraqi. They left just before the start of the Iran war. So when Saddam took power and they had, like, my dad, I guess, had the foresight to come and move to the UK. I, as you know, graduated as a doctor initially, well, God knows how many years ago now.
As an MD, not a PhD,
as
guys.
As an MD, yeah, as a hospital doctor. And kind of realized quite quickly on that it wasn't really my passion, and began shifting towards more like storytelling and journalism. And that's where I am now, and that's where you find me doing the things that I do.
And so tell us about your relationship to Iraq.
I guess it's an interesting, like, you grow up as almost like a in between cultures, like in the UK, you know, your parents obviously are immigrants, so they talk to you about Iraq all the time. And the kind of the image that you get presented as like the child of immigrants is that this is a beautiful country, that, you know, the heritage, the culture, all of that is just like this beautiful image that you have. And then at the same time, being British in the UK, you're kind of like mixed, caught between the two cultures. So the relationship that I developed was because you hear all these stories, it was something that I wanted to explore. And unfortunately for me, going to Iraq, I went a couple of times as a child, so I can't really comment on them. But the first time I went as an adult was after the invasion. So I think I went in 2014 was the first time that I went as an adult. And just the devastation that you see just kind of didn't reflect the stories that I'd imagined in my head as what Iraq really is, that what we'd been told. And it became almost like this idea that Baghdad was almost like literally just an idea in my head as opposed to a reality, because it just didn't reflect what I'd known and what the world had like almost described Baghdad to be. And so obviously the stories of the death, the destruction, and now, like, sadly, Iraq has become synonymous with war and violence. Like, even, I don't know if you remember the insurrection on January 6th, and all the troops that were in the National Guard when they were put onto DC, you found all these journalists that were like, oh my God, this isn't downtown Baghdad, this is DC, how do we have troops on this? And it's like, for me, reading those kind of things really shocked me. And I'm like, no, this isn't what Iraq is synonymous with. There's a lot more to this culture and idea. So there's kind of like this weird contradiction between what the reality is and what I can kind of understand.
And so what did you do when you were in Iraq, when you were there as an adult?
So initially I was doing research for a master's degree. So I was looking at the impact of violence on healthcare workers in a conflict zone. And then I started working in journalism. I was like writing stories. And so that's kind of the stuff that I was doing. I worked for a few NGOs as well at the time, but mainly I was doing like the storytelling, and I worked on some film projects and things.
And so tell us what your thoughts are on Colin Powell and what made you write this piece at The Independent.
Yeah, so it's an interesting one. I think a few things are quite important to reflect on. And I think number one is like when you read all these obituaries, and like you said, how you have Public Enemy writing these things, and then Joe Biden calling him a devout patriot, and George Bush as well, like writing these obituaries and statements. And it's just like, this isn't really who the man was. And it's kind of quite common what we do with politicians around the world. Whenever they die, we kind of whitewash the atrocities that they committed, as opposed to actually come and like really talk about it. No, this isn't a guy that I should celebrate. He's a guy that sat in front of the UN at the Security Council meeting and flat out lied. Like he said one thing and behind closed doors said another thing. One of the things he said at that meeting was, he said, I have no doubt in my head, I'm paraphrasing, he said, I have no doubt that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. And then in private meetings with his chief of staff, he was asking the question, what if we send 500,000 troops into Iraq, go from the south to the north, and we don't find weapons of mass destruction? And the reality was, he just showed that he had doubt, but he chose to lie in front of the UN Security Council. And this kind of like peddling towards, or warmongering, I would say, towards violence in Iraq and the military industrial complex was the cause of hundreds of thousands of deaths, millions of Iraqis displaced, and the ongoing suffering. And he never sought justice for it. And that's what disappoints me the most. Reading like a lot of the op-ed pieces, or the focus has been on his vaccination status. Oh my God, like he was double vaccinated but still died of COVID. And I'm like, this guy was never trialed. People have gone to prison for a lot less. And yet this guy sought out his like last few remaining days, like relatively comfortable with his family. So it's just an interesting perspective to have.
Yeah, we actually have that video. We can watch some of it, unless it's maybe too infuriating, but we can probably watch part of it. We can do like a Mystery Science Theater thing with it, where we watch part of the testimony and we can comment on it.
I think it's worth, you know, watching, diving in just to see what he really did at this pivotal moment. It's pretty rare that you get to see the most important moment in someone's life on videotape, and we get to see his, and we really can be, you know, the judge.
Yeah.
It's rare that you actually can, you know, stand in judgment of somebody's actions, but hey, they're here, they're laid out, and he committed to this on camera for the world to see. That was the point.
Right. So we probably should honor him by watching this. And this is from the UN shortly before, you know, he was the guy who had the cred to sell this war when he was Secretary of State.
I can share with you, when combined with what all of us have learned over the years, is deeply troubling. What you will see is an accumulation of facts and disturbing patterns of behavior. The facts and Iraq's behavior demonstrate that Saddam Hussein and his regime have made no effort to disarm as required by the international community. Indeed, the facts and Iraq's behavior show that Saddam Hussein and his regime are concealing their efforts to produce more weapons of mass destruction.
You see, he doesn't sound unsure to me. He sounds pretty sure. Oh, you don't have to unpause it. He just seems like the confidence, like people are talking about it's a mistake. He sounds pretty sure of himself right here.
Support of terrorism long before these terrorist networks had a name. And this support continues. The nexus of poisons and terror is new. The nexus.
He sounds more confident than I am when I give my birthday at the pharmacy. Like that's like he's more sure of this than anything else.
Take their place alongside the other Iraqi denials of weapons of mass destruction. It is all a web of lies. When we confront a regime that harbors ambitions for regional domination, hides weapons of mass destruction, and provides haven and active support for terrorists, we are not confronting the past. We are confronting the present And unless we act, we are confronting an even
frightening future. As Glovearm says, what he's sure of is that he won't get in trouble for these lies. That's why he's confident. That's why he's confident. He knows he won't pay any consequences for it, which turned out to be the case.
It should be a subject of deep and continuing concern to this council. Saddam Hussein's violations of human rights. Underlying all that I have said, underlying all the facts and the patterns of behavior that I have identified, is Saddam Hussein's contempt for the will of this council, his contempt for the truth, and most damning of all.
I always find it fascinating that Clinton was impeached for lying about having sexual relations. And I understand that's under oath and things, but this resulted in people's death, as in quite literally people's death. And nobody kind of, no judgment, no testimonies, no judicial hearings, nothing.
Hussein's use of mustard and nerve gas against the Kurds in 1988 was one of the 20th century's most horrible atrocities. 5,000 men, women, and children died. His campaign against the Kurds from 1987 to 89 included mass summary executions, disappearances, arbitrary jailing, ethnic cleansing, and the destruction of some 2,000 villages. He has also conducted ethnic cleansing against the Shia Iraqis and the Marsh Arabs, whose culture has flourished for more than a millennium.
Saddam Hussein. Yeah, and he's not mentioning how he, what weapons he used and who he got them from for these acts of ethnic cleansing. He's not mentioning the fact that he was a U.S. ally.
Also, the when he refers to the Shia ethnic cleansing, and that's he's referring to them after the 91 Gulf War. George H.W., so the original George Bush, he actually gave support towards the Shia, saying, I will support you in your bid to overthrow Saddam. They turned their back on him. They turned their back on the Shia. So Saddam took the onus on him to then go commit genocide. So he was also, and he was at the time chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So he was also complicit in that genocide by turning their back on a pledge that they'd made of support.
Yeah. And I'm glad that you mentioned, we're going to get to this shortly, but whenever you want to talk, just talk and we'll pause it. But I'm glad you mentioned the first Gulf War in your piece, by the way, because that's something that's often incorrectly framed as the good Gulf War.
Yeah.
Who dares to dissent? Iraq has more forced disappearance cases than any other country. Tens of thousands of people reported missing in the past decade. Nothing points more clearly to Saddam Hussein's dangerous intentions and the threat he poses to all of us than his calculated cruelty to his own citizens and to his neighbors. Clearly, Saddam Hussein and his regime will stop at nothing until something stops him. For more than 20 years, by word and by deed, Saddam Hussein has pursued his ambition to dominate Iraq and the broader Middle East using the only means he knows, intimidation, coercion, and annihilation of all those who might stand in his way.
Well, someone does that. Saddam Hussein, possession that of the is someone's MO, but not Iraq's.
The ultimate Trump
I believe
card,
that's the United States.
The one he must hold to fulfill his ambition. We know that Saddam Hussein is determined to keep his weapons of mass destruction. He's determined to make more. Given Saddam Hussein's history of aggression, given what we know of his grandiose plans, given what we know of his terrorist associations, and given his determination,
and that was disproved, the link between Al Qaeda and Saddam.
Oh, right. So the link between Al Qaeda and Saddam, right?
Was this? Yeah. Donald Rumsfeld made the same statement as well, saying there's a direct link, and it was disproved later on.
Yeah,
there's a good piece in the Washington Post about that, if anyone's interested.
Well, Ari Fleischer, all praise be upon him, after Bush was even president. In 2006, I believe, he said that we couldn't take the chance that he was defending invading Iraq and overthrowing Saddam Hussein. He said we couldn't take the chance that we'd be hit again after 9/11.
Yeah.
He said this on Hardball with Chris Matthews.
Yeah.
And somehow Chris Matthews didn't even catch that. And this was after Bush himself admitted that there was no connection.
I've written a piece similar to the one about Powell after Rumsfeld's death. And I describe how after 6 hours after the Twin Towers fell, Donald Rumsfeld wrote a note when he was Secretary of Defense. He wrote a note saying, find a way to link this back to Saddam Hussein. Like, as in, and he didn't care what how valid that evidence was. He just said, find a way that we can now attack Saddam. So it was clear that historically, these were all like fabricated statements for to, I guess, garner public support into an Iraq invasion.
Should we take the risk that he will not someday use these weapons at a time and a place and in a manner of his choosing, at a time when the world is in a much weaker position to respond? The United States will not and cannot run that risk to the American people. Leaving Saddam Hussein in possession of weapons of mass destruction for a few more months or years is not an option, not in a post-September 11th world. My colleagues, over 3 months ago, this council recognized that Iraq continued to pose a threat to international peace and security, and that Iraq had been and remained in material breach of its disarmament obligations. Today, Iraq still poses a threat, and Iraq still remains in material breach. Indeed, by its failure to seize on its one last opportunity to come clean and disarm, Iraq has put itself in deeper material breach and closer to the day when it will face serious consequences for its continued defiance of this council. My colleagues, we have an obligation to our citizens. We have an obligation to this body to see that our resolutions are complied with. We wrote 1441 not in order to go to war. We wrote 1441 to try to preserve the peace. We wrote 1441 to give Iraq one last chance. Iraq is not so far taking that one last chance. We must not shrink from whatever is ahead of us. We must not fail in our duty and our responsibility to the citizens of the countries that are represented by this body.
Okay, so this was not some mistake, right? Ahmed, can you talk to us about something about this, which you mentioned in your piece, how he was very intentionally misrepresenting the truth. And in fact, he didn't want to invade Iraq, right? He opposed that decision?
He was hesitant. I wouldn't go so much as to say fully opposed it. I think that's kind of something that was said about him in retrospect.
And I didn't mean that to give him credit. I meant that he didn't actually, I think he thought that perhaps wouldn't be strategic.
He went along with it, even though he knew it was wrong.
Which makes it maybe worse, but sorry, I cut you off.
As in he's himself has admitted that, like, what he was worried is that it's almost a blot on his reputation is what he said in the past. Which for me, I think is even such a disrespectful way to even talk about something like that. Like, people haven't sought justice and are suffering and you're worried about your reputation, like, kind of just isn't quite fair. But he wasn't as, I guess, pro-war as someone like Rumsfeld was, but still publicly pushed the line for war and told the stories. And, you know, he even falsified evidence. So in that speech as well, at one point he says that Iraqis like hid all the weapons of mass destruction, and he quotes a piece. And then actually the actual translation from the State Department of this quote that he's given isn't that they hid them, is that they were saying, we offered you to come look for the weapons of mass destruction. So it's kind of like he was actively choosing to mistell the truths in order to garner support for, like, the UN Resolution 4041 and what happened after.
Right. Yes. It said he misrepresented the actual language.
Yeah, as in, I can quote to you exactly what was said if you give me a second.
Sure.
And Bob Woodward actually describes it in his book as well. So he'd written... What he said and what he quoted was that the Iraqi Republican Guard had created a system of hiding things and moving things out of the way. And what he said was they requested them to clean out all areas, the scrap areas, the abandoned areas, make sure nothing is there. And the original message that the State Department has since released was that what the Iraqis said was to inspect the scrap areas and abandoned areas. What Powell added was to clean out all the areas. So he added that sentence, to clean out, to make it look like the Iraqis were covering up for something which they weren't, and we've since found out later. So yeah, you're right. Like he did, he was more hesitant than people like Rumsfeld, but still peddled the same lies that they were peddling. Like Rumsfeld even to at one point said, I know exactly where the WMDs are. Like he said, I can pinpoint them for you. And, you know, to this day, we're still looking.
Right. Remember Bush joked about them being under his desk?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that was at the press dinner, right?
I don't know. I think he actually did it like in his actual office. I think it was even worse. I think maybe he did it twice. Maybe it was part of his repertoire.
Yeah.
Then, of course, Obama joked about droning the Jonas Brothers if they dated his daughters. That was at the White House press dinner.
Yeah.
Even though he did let his daughter intern with Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah, it's a good point. Yeah. Just to clarify. So, and Wilkerson, right? Wilkerson, who was his chief of staff. Chief of staff,
yeah.
Was distraught by this, at least in retrospect, right? You mentioned that.
Yeah, so he'd written how Colin Powell, like as soon as he like left that meeting, especially how he was openly in doubt about what he was saying, but he still chose to still talk about those issues.
Yeah.
But then again, it's like just because you present doubt in private, but you continue to do things publicly, doesn't make you not any less complicit. You're still...
No. I think this is what makes part of his legacy and his life so troubling is that he was supposed to be the adult in the room.
Yeah.
Like he's not an ideological neocon the same way. I mean, he's part of the military industrial complex. He's an imperialist, right? But like he wasn't the unhinged neocon that Rumsfeld was, which makes his like calculated decision to lie that much more disturbing in some ways.
No, I agree, but I think he's developed, maybe it's in order to progress politically, but he kind of had this trend where he's done it in the past. And I guess the 91 war was another example where he did a very similar thing when they bombed the only baby formula factory in Iraq. And he released a statement saying, we know for sure that this wasn't a baby formula. And then
said it is not an infant formula factory. It was a biological weapons facility. Of that, we are sure.
Yeah. And then they later found out that actually, no, it was a baby formula factory. And then you have the My Lai massacre in Vietnam as well, where 500 unarmed, in what's been described as a war crime, 500 unarmed Vietnamese in South Vietnam were killed by American soldiers. And he was sent to investigate, and he turned around saying, you know, relations between the Vietnamese and American people are at an all-time high.
Yeah.
And I just guess that, yeah, maybe he doesn't believe what he's saying entirely, but it's almost narcissistic to say these things to be able to progress in your career when you're looking out for your own like career benefits. If he disagreed with the Iraq war and pushed against Bush, I don't think he would have been stayed in the administration. He'd probably been kicked out. And that's why he was willing to sit there and continue peddling the lies that George Bush was so adamant to follow.
And can you talk about the Powell Doctrine, which you also mentioned in your piece?
Yeah, so it's an interesting doctrine. So it's like quite a lot of people have actually praised it. And I think there are some positives of it where it's a number of different things that he recommends as prerequisites to American military intervention. And it's things like, has diplomacy been tried? Has this been tried? Has that been tried? But should all of those factors have been addressed, what he then proposed was for maximum use of force to once and for all annihilate whatever it is that they were going to attack. So that was applied in the 91 Gulf War after the Iraq invaded Kuwait. Obviously, they quite quickly lost to the Americans. So when they began retreating, part of what the Powell Doctrine suggested was you need to destroy everything in its process. So this is considered a potential war crime as well. When an army is retreating, the Americans went and annihilated the retreating soldiers and the tanks and the people like that. So it was quite difficult for us to understand really, you know, he's presented it as something that's good, this Powell Doctrine, but in reality, when it's implemented, it's actually quite devastating and innocent lives are definitely going to be lost in the process.
Yeah, I mean, and you refer to the highway of death.
Yeah, so that was, yeah, it was all, they were all on one road, this retreating army. There was one road from Kuwait back to Basra. And it's been dubbed Highway of Death because it was just...
Highway 80, I think.
Highway 80, yeah. Yeah, yeah. And it was just like non-stop attack by the Americans, and just killed and destroyed any tank, any of the soldiers that were along on the route.
Yeah, it was really disgusting. Total war crime. I mean, reading at Jalopnik, I guess they published this in January 2016 because it was the 25-year anniversary. Iraqi forces were annihilated while retreating on the Highway of Death 25 years ago. Highway 80 was a six-lane highway leading across the desert from Basra, Iraq, to Kuwait City. It was one of the main highways that gave Iraq quick access into Kuwait during their invasion of the country, but their return trip would be much less triumphant and horrifically deadly. On the night of February 26, 1991, after over a month of heavy bombardment and facing the full onslaught of advancing coalition ground forces, thousands of Iraqi military personnel and vehicles, as well as a sea of stolen Kuwaiti cars parked with looted valuables, attempted to retreat from Kuwait. At the time, Iraq had announced that it would withdraw, but it had not yet accepted the UN resolutions passed against them. There were not many route options that ran between Iraq and Kuwait to stage a large-scale military retreat. As a result, a massive amount of Saddam's forces deployed months earlier to seize Kuwait were now crowded along the few highways that led out of the country and into Iraq, the main one being Highway 80. The intelligence on the ground in Kuwait reported that the Iraqis were packing up, but no hard actionable intelligence could be had for targeting the retreating force. Kuwaiti intelligence advisors told U.S. commanders that their countrymen would not be among the traffic leaving and that the coalition should engage freely. Then one of America's newest super weapons, the E-8 Joint Surveillance and Targeting Radar System, made to detect and track moving vehicles on the ground, reported something unusual. What appeared on their radar scopes seemed to be a huge convoy traveling north, leaving Kuwait City and heading towards Kuwait's northern border with Iraq. USMCA-6E intruders that were patrolling the Kuwaiti coastline were first on the scene and armed ideally for the grim job at hand. The jets were carrying Mark 20 Rockeye cluster munitions, which could rain devastation of a fairly wide area. The intruders aimed at the front and rear of the convoy. If the munitions landed correctly, the tactic would trap all the remaining vehicles in between burning vehicles and cratered sections of highway on both ends of the convoy. In effect, it would turn the roughly 4 mile stretch of road into a bombing range. The cluster munitions did their job. Both ends of escape were cut off, and vehicles at the head of the convoy careened into one another if they were not destroyed by the crescendo of submunitions. Yeah. So there's nothing like it, according to an A-10 Warthog pilot involved in the attacks. There was just nothing like it. It's the biggest 4th of July show you've ever seen. And to see those tanks just going boom and more stuff just keep spewing out of them and shells flying out to the ground, they just become white hot. It's wonderful.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, the journalists on TV talked a lot about this too. They were very happy to see the bombing and the explosions. They really, I forget, was it Brokaw or one of the major anchors was just talking about how beautiful it was to see on TV. I remember watching the coverage because it was generally considered the first live TV war where you can see us raining death upon people like live while it was happening.
Yeah. Yeah. And they think that like 500 to 600 people died in the Highway of Death.
Yeah, yeah. The numbers aren't. They don't know. As in, some numbers go into the thousands. Yeah, they don't.
Right.
You can't tell.
Yeah, it's probably more than whatever the estimates are that we hear about in the United States. There's video, so that's the highway.
As in, you can see there's nowhere for them to go to stay safe. This is just a road that's left on fire.
Yeah,
I just find it funny how we talk about all these people. Like we talk about, let's say Saddam doing like terrible things. Oh, this is when it was made into a video game by Call of Duty, I think. And
this is
interesting. They changed it from Americans to Russians.
Yes, yes. This was very interesting. They did the Highway of Death, but they said, it wasn't Americans who did it, it was the Russians.
Yeah.
Oh, they made the Russians do it?
Yes.
Yeah. It was the Russians that were the bad guys doing it, not the Americans.
That's funny that they came up, but that actually is really relevant.
Yeah, it is.
There's an interesting game coming out called 6 Days in Fallujah. I don't know if you've heard of it. I've written a whole piece on it actually for Foreign Policy, but it's looking at, it's basically you play the role of an American in that 6 days of insurgency in Fallujah, of them trying to like fight the insurgency in Fallujah. And you play the role of an American soldier going door to door, and you'll open the door and see like innocent Iraqi families like shivering, and you have to make the decision, do you kill them or not? And you play this as a game. And like it's what some people have considered a war crime, where over 800 people have died, and the use of white phosphorus and things like that. And it's been turned into an entertainment. Like it's quite a difficult thing to consider. And then you've got this example where the Russians are made the bad guys, and what, like, yes, whitewashing the American like story. Like it's a bit surreal.
Yeah. It's awful. Yeah. And no one talks about that. No one's heard of the Highway of Death.
Yeah. And the other thing, like where Colin Powell was like, I guess, complaining about the use of chemical weapons by Saddam Hussein on the Kurds. But, you know, like at the time there was a bust of Winston Churchill sat in the White House in the Oval Office. And the first person to advocate for the use of chemical weapons against the Kurds is Winston Churchill.
Oh, wow.
Back in the 1920s. And, you know, we whitewashed that storyline, and he's now presented as
a hero,
a war hero. And revered within the White House and the UK.
Right.
But I think what you were saying before I even came on about how, like, you know, Colin Powell was someone who's black. It's quite an interesting thing. Like, people kind of, like, admire the fact, oh, it's the first black NSA, National Security Advisor, the first black, you know, in the administration. It's quite... And I would say this is a similar story with someone like Hillary Clinton, where everyone's like, let's vote for her as president. You know, about time we have the first woman president. And, you know, I completely support a woman going for president, just not her. Like, just because Colin Powell was black doesn't mean he made good decisions. Just because Hillary Clinton was a woman doesn't mean she would have made a good president. As in, I still think that had she been president, we would have seen troops in Syria. Like, it's quite... Right. It's quite difficult when the liberals just can't see past the reality. They just see literally the surface thing. Oh, you know, let's have the first black president, the first black secretary of defense, the first black. But when you just go a little bit scratch under the surface, you see quite a lot different.
How do you compare Rumsfeld? It must have been a hard year it's been a hard year for all of us between Rumsfeld and Powell.
I'm sure you're still in mourning.
Well, Rumsfeld was, I don't know how you compared the two of them, but I do know one thing, which is that only one of the two men was in People's Most Beautiful People.
Sexiest. Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I'm not even kidding.
You know, I can believe was? That.
Was I not on the list?
I would assume Colin Powell. I would assume Colin Powell would be one of the sexiest people, because Rumsfeld was always controversial. Colin Powell always had a good...
Rumsfeld was actually beloved, like, by the media. They literally loved him. I don't know what it was. Maybe his, like, what I would say is, like, his belligerent smile. But the media kind of loved him. He used to
say
facts as they were.
See, I was already watching more left sort of media by that time with what Rumsfeld, so maybe I don't have the memory, but I do remember Colin Powell always had the positive, but Rumsfeld, sexiest man. Wow.
People names Rummy sexiest. Yeah,
I
remember
need to
when
go
this happened.
Do a deep dive into the Rumsfeld
I'm
love.
Trying
I do
to
not remember this.
People magazine in its annual Sexiest Man Alive issue has named U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, 70. This is in 2002. The sexiest cabinet member. Wow. People lauds Rumsfeld for his blunt talk and wry humor, and quote CNN Pentagon correspondent Barbara Starr calling him a big, flirty pussycat.
It's like
when you're competing with George Bush, then...
The chat is split, because half of us remember Rumsfeld always just being a creep, and the other half do remember this. This is very strange. I always thought Rumsfeld was a creep, and everybody knew he was kind of a creep, but I guess... We have the facts here. He was kind of treated with this.
The media turned on him. I think it was around 2004. That's when the media really turned on him. So, like, if you were following before that, maybe he was a lot more loved, and then they turned on him after.
Well, let's see who the competition was, because obviously you got like, you know, the real guys that he was up against, Ben Affleck, Tom Cruise, John Leguizamo, right? George Clooney. Okay, that's one thing. But the people that from the cabinet that he beat were, let's see, this guy, Norman Mineta, transportation secretary. I don't remember him at all. Do you guys remember Norm?
Norm Mineta.
Hold on, let me show you him. This is what he looks like. Okay, so this is Norman. No memory of him. Do you guys remember him?
Japanese immigrant parents. Mineta.
Oh, Mineta, not Italian, like I was saying.
It's Japanese, so Mineta. Yeah.
Mineta, yeah. So, okay, nice comb over.
Not striking me as terribly sexy.
No, not
I like the glasses, I'll be honest.
Yeah, the glasses are good. Oh, he was actually in an internment camp.
Wow.
Yeah. That's fascinating. I'll read his book. Wow. Interesting life, but not a good guy because he was worked for Bush. He was in the Bush administration, the Bush cabinet. And then John Ashcroft. I mean, that is just like, you guys have seen John Ashcroft, right? I mean, honestly, it should have been Mineta out of the three of them. Definitely should have been Mineta. Hold on, let me show you Ashcroft. Ashcroft was in the Singing Senators. I don't know if you know about them.
You should do a Twitter about on this.
This is the sexiest war criminal.
Yeah,
I mean, Ashcroft, he just looks like a gallon of milk. Like, there's nothing sexy about him. Yeah,
he's really, no, not
maybe
at
he's
all.
Tall or something, and that impressed the journalists. I don't know. They're impressed.
Rumsfeld or Ashcroft?
Maybe Ashcroft is like 6'4 or something. He looks he might be a tall guy. I don't know. I'm just guessing.
Oh, you're guessing, yeah. Guessing. Yeah. I don't know. Anyway, well, yeah, so Powell did not make that. Rumsfeld beat him on that count.
Yeah, I'm sure Powell's turning in his grave still because of that.
I know, Leslie, you have to leave soon, but Leslie, do you want to make any final comments or ask Ahmed anything? And then maybe if I can steal a couple more minutes from you, even though it's late where you are.
Oh, yeah, no. I think we've just been having a great conversation. It's just nice to remember who Colin Powell really was. Like every opportunity in his life, he, whether it was My Lai, whether it was the first Iraq War, the second Iraq War, he chose to say yes, sir, to whoever asked him to do something. And he never took a stand for anybody or anything but his own career.
Did you guys see Donald Trump's comments on him?
Oh, yes. That was great.
When Donald Trump beats
Katie, you should read it in the voice. You gotta read it in the voice.
I'm not good at. Can you do it?
I can't do. I can't really do Bernie. If Bernie said something, I can fake a Trump.
Let's try it. Let me look for
statement. Let me pull it. If you can pull it up, I forget.
All right,
one of the funniest things ever. All right, I have it.
Okay, you have it. All right.
All right. Statement by Donald J. Trump, 45th President of the United States of America. Wonderful to see Colin Powell, who made big mistakes on Iraq and famously so-called weapons of mass destruction, be treated in death so beautifully by the fake news media. Hope that happens to me someday. He was a classic rhino, if even that, always being the first to attack other Republicans. He made plenty of mistakes, but anyway, may he rest in peace.
That's so great.
But anyway,
may he rest in peace.
It's so good. No, it's perfect. It's the best thing anyone had to say about, to be honest.
It really is. It's so good. We should read all of his comments on everyone.
Oh, he said something about Liz Cheney today. Low polling Liz Cheney, 19%, is actually very bad news for the Democrats. People absolutely cannot stand her as she fights for the people that have decimated her and her father for many years. She is a smug fool, and the great state of Wyoming, together with the Republican Party, fully understands her act. To look at her is to despise her. Hopefully she will continue down this unsustainable path and she will soon be gone. Man, it almost makes you miss him. It almost makes you miss it.
I know.
At least somebody's telling the truth. I mean, because Liz Cheney is tied in sometimes, this as yeah. well. Is just an absolute monster, and is to know her, is to despise her. So I think that absolutely fair as well.
Low polling Liz.
Yeah, did you see the tweet she put where she like, literally she was like, I love presidents who get voted twice, and put a picture of George Bush. Like,
oh,
it's just she put, I think this is last week, and it's just like, come on, like you're literally promoting somebody who I think most of America now recognizes as a possible war criminal.
Yes,
no,
yes.
He's part of the resistance.
And the funny thing is, she could have actually
he's dancing with Ellen DeGeneres on TV and a national
and that's funny, because if she's actually were going to reach out to all these Democrats that are trying to defend her, she would have posted a picture of Obama, because he got elected twice. Like, why is she wants all these people to know that she has no respect for them, like not even not even a little bit. She's not going to give an inch. So I don't know
why. Father is like, I mean, he's such a disgust. To know what he say to see her is to loathe her.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, then to see, but if that's true, then to see Dick Cheney is to what wanna like actually.
Well, we can't say it again.
Can't say anything, right?
No, we can't say it on YouTube.
Want to throw a party?
I just hope that you know one day the gang is hold all together. You know, Rumsfeld, Colin, Dick, Georgie. I hope they Condi. I hope they're all together very, very soon. That's all I'll say.
Yeah,
get the band back together.
Yeah, we want to get the band.
COVID, get the band back together. COVID, get the band back together.
It's just disgusting knowing that Bush is now an artist.
Oh yeah,
proponent of immigrants and all this stuff. It's just. And having interviews, like, it's just, like, seeing those things disgusts me. Like, how?
Did you see this, by the way?
Yeah.
Stop anti-Semitism. The nation's Palestine correspondent, Time Magazine's most influential 100 people for 2021, just wished death on Henry Kissinger, a Jewish man. Okay. And then they quote Mohammed El-Kurd tweeting, why is it never Henry Kissinger? I'm offended as a Jew that Henry Kissinger is framed as a Jewish man.
I honestly, Katie, I've talked a lot about how much I hate this man. I did not know he was Jewish, and I just want to apologize to you. I think maybe
for
I knew
it.
I just never thought about
him.
It
oh,
because it
I
doesn't
see.
Matter. You know, I might have
but
heard
he never
the
like
fact.
Openly identified as like.
Well, Jewish, no, not like, only that. Well, so I tweeted, "Stop anti-Semitism's Twitter account just invisibilized the countless Jews like me who asked the same question about Henry Kissinger. Stop the erasure." Because two can play at that game. But no, he has this quote about not caring about the Soviets gassing Jews and how it's not an American problem. He's also a fancy, not to, okay, a little bit of like inter-Jew inside baseball. He's a fancy German Jew.
Yeah.
See, he's not like shtetl Eastern European Jew. They
he's
weren't
bougie.
Very good. He's very, he's bougie Jew. You know, he has a brother, Walter, who died in 2021. So we lost one Kissinger this year. And he was 96.
People did propose the disturbing theory that he's actually absorbing the life force of the other war criminals. And so that every time like one of these headlines happens, he's actually becoming more powerful.
Yeah,
I wouldn't put it past him.
Me neither. Him and Dick Cheney, maybe.
It sounds like to have a long life, the more crimes you do, the longer
better,
you live.
Yeah,
like,
the longer
yes, you live. Yeah. Yes, very Lovecraftian. Well, Katie, I do have to go.
Liz has to go.
But Ahmed, thank you so much. Great article. So wonderful meeting you. Rest in peace, Colin Powell. Thank you all so much. Have a good night.
Bye, Leslie.
Bye.
And anything else you wanted to tell us about, you know, you still have family there in Iraq, by the way?
Yeah, I've still got some aunts and uncles out there.
So how did your family have any feelings about his passing?
I guess for lack of a better word, it's like, I guess, good riddance almost.
Right.
Yeah. It's just the infuriation of never seeing justice.
Right.
Like, yeah.
Yes. As you write, you say at the end, right? You say at the end of your piece,
let's get Bush before it's too late.
Yeah. Right. Before it's too late, we must hold to account George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, and the other surviving engineers of the catastrophe Iraq endures to this day.
I would add Henry Kissinger to that list as well.
Yeah. Never forget Henry. Stop invisibilizing him. Yeah.
Hashtag it.
Hashtag, yeah. Hashtag never forget Henry. NFH. And you write quite frequently. You have a couple of really great pieces, but one I want to ask you about was the climate piece that you wrote, also in the Independent. Climate crisis demands, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Climate crisis demands a redistribution of wealth to fix it. So can you just summarize to people what your argument is there?
Yeah. So I guess it's kind of like looking at history as to how America and like the UK and other like developed nations are so big and powerful, and it's because they've historically abused the climate crisis, the environment, through like deforestation. Like 75% of America's forests were completely like destroyed, and that was to grow cotton. There was a slave by the name of John Parker who became an abolitionist after, and he wrote he would see fields and fields of forests and forests just on fire, and that was just so that people could grow cotton, and that's where America's economy was built from. And it's kind of like this history of and like I guess it's continued abuse of the climate by Western powers, and we kind of almost assume that developed countries are going to be able to achieve the same thing. And unfortunately, even like kind of powerful economies like I would say like Brazil and China, they're never going to be able to compete with America, who's now almost reached a place where it can rely on fossil fuels less than it did before, because of how, I guess, developed it has the renewable sources, which are way too expensive for countries in Africa to develop, to purchase. So the only way for us to be able to really consider climate change and to tackle it is to have a lot of the money that's, I guess, hoarded in the West, redistributed to the rest of the world so that we can tackle this jointly. Because there's no way that a country like America would be so powerful if they hadn't exploited the environment. And we can't expect a country in a poor country, let's say in Africa, to develop well if it doesn't exploit the environment as well. Like, it's just too expensive for them to be able to achieve. And I think some of the things that continue to happen, like, yes, Joe Biden walks around saying that, you know, it's like code red for climate crisis, and, you know, let's have a whole of government technique to tackling climate change. It's fair enough that he says that. Fair enough that he, like, signs back into the Paris Agreement and the liberals, like, are all excited about it. But he's also signed 78 million acres of offshore drilling off the Gulf of Mexico for oil. So, and that's like a huge amount of oil to happen. And the same thing like with Justin Trudeau and how everyone, all the liberals loved, like we're talking about how great he is as well. And then at the same time, he signed the bill for the Keystone Pipeline. And it just continues to happen. And there's also the Line 3 that Joe Biden has signed and approved, which is another like massively carbon emitting project. So it's this whole, I guess, unfairness that I'm arguing in the article, where countries in the past have exploited the environment, and we're expecting poorer countries to be able to do the same, to be able to help tackle the climate crisis, and they never will be able to achieve that. Biden's done a bunch of other things as well, like his industrial plan. So this whole Build Back Better business that he's been talking about, he's removed a lot of the Green New Deal plans that he had suggested.
Okay, let's see. This is a question related back to what we were talking about earlier. But Wendy Melly asks, Ahmed, is your family in Iraq able to live normally? Is the U.S. still a notable occupying presence there?
So the U.S. withdrew from Iraq in 2011, like, as in technically withdrew from Iraq. So there's no real presence on the street. There are still military bases where the U.S. Army is there, but they're not, you don't really see them. There is, like, it's an unstable country. So it depends how you define normal, really. I agree with that last statement about Line 3, yeah.
It's beyond, Carne Verde writes, it's beyond depressing to see MSM lack of coverage about Line 3. Yeah, we did a show about this. with Dallas Goldtooth, but we need to do another one. You had also had a piece on Afghanistan.
So I don't know if you remember, there was the attack on the airport that happened, and then 13 US soldiers died. And that was kind of what grabbed all the headlines across America, that 13 years. And in that same attack, countless number of Afghans died. And for me, that was what I wrote. I was like, Afghan lives basically matter also. Like, it's not just the American servicemen who died, who were like there technically in combat. It's also about the innocent Afghans who died as well. Like, we need to mention those names and numbers. So that's what I'm discussing in that article. And it happens all the time. Like, it's always just like this kind of like number that we kind of quote. Whereas when it comes to American lives, we kind of revere them a lot more than anywhere else. Like, if there was an attack if there's a bomb that happens in Baghdad, it probably wouldn't even reach headline news. Whereas if, you know, an attack happens in America and not even someone doesn't even die. So like, I don't know if you remember in December, there was the attack in Nashville, the bomb in Nashville, when nobody died, in Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And that was like headline news for a couple of days. I guess it's understandable because it's domestic, but at the same time, when it happens in Baghdad and hundreds of people die, it doesn't really, those lives still matter too, kind of thing.
Right. Unless they're, if they're American lives and they,
if they're American,
like if they're servicemen,
yeah. They're going to hit the headlines quick time.
Right. Yeah. It's very depressing. And then you had your COVID article. So then you had the climate change article, you had a COVID article. Then you had your pinned tweet is a really good Israel Palestine one that you wrote.
So there's a few of the Israel Palestine one, I guess that was, an attack that happened that during the recent violence between Gaza and Israel, where Israeli airstrikes attacked an MSF health clinic, and I just argued, was just discussing how attack on healthcare systems across the world, as in the sanctity of health, has completely been obliterated, even though it's been for decades considered a war crime if health facilities are attacked. But unfortunately, Israel has made it somewhat of a trend and seem to get away with it when they have the excuse of saying, oh yeah, but Hamas is doing something there. Nobody needs to investigate it anymore. And it's just my call of saying, actually, no, we do need transparent investigations. Like, you can't take the word of an aggressor. It's like saying, you know, if somebody's committed a crime in your city, he's going to be the person that investigates his own crime. We would never accept it anywhere else, but we seem to have accepted it in the time of war. So that's kind of what that article talks about. That one is quite, it's kind of, what's interesting is that attack or attacking hospitals in general, was set as a precedent by the US. So I don't know if you remember in 2015 when the Americans attacked a hospital in Kunduz, Afghanistan, over the period of 1 hour, when the Afghans were sending messages saying, don't attack us, don't attack us. Like when the MSF, the Doctors Without Borders were sending messages saying, don't attack us. The Americans replied saying, we will do our best praying for you, was the response, as opposed to let's stop. Obviously thoughts and prayers is something that's going to help them. And that set a precedent for when Saudi bombed a Doctors Without Borders hospital in Yemen, because it became a kind of a process where people were saying, you know, it was an accident. We didn't know it was a hospital. America was never like charged for it. We shouldn't be charged for it either. And then Israel has done it a few times in the past as well. This most recent example is just one of them, but they've attacked hospitals before. They've killed like patients in hospitals before. And then also Bashar al-Assad did the same thing in Syria. So it's kind of become more of a precedent that's been happening over and over. So that's what that piece relates to.
Yeah. Did you see Abby Martin's film Gaza Fight for Freedom?
Yeah.
Which Abby Martin and Mike Preisner. It's like, it's a really effective film in part because they're so, and it's funny because Abby and Mike are both very, in a very good way, kind of not emotional, but they are very they're righteously indignant often, as they should be. And this is just, they're kind of, you know, just go through exactly why Israel's crimes are so indisputable.
Yeah.
It's just like, you know, this UN law, this UN charter, this UN convention. And one of the things, one of the focuses of the film for people who haven't seen it is how they target healthcare workers. And that's something you wrote about.
Yeah.
That you were, and so what did you focus on when you were doing that? Like what can you share your findings?
So
your master's.
Yeah. So that was Iraq specific. So that was, slightly different. Like what I found with that one was that actually it's, what I expected to find, like what my, like, I guess hypothesis was that it's going to be like the risk of terrorism and insurgency on Iraqi healthcare workers and kidnapping and things like that. But actually what I found was that it was tribal retribution that was the biggest violent risk to Iraqi doctors. And the reason is the system that works in Iraq, because there is no rule of law and there is no state structure, if a mistake happens or if anything happens in a hospital, if a patient dies, tribes demand justice and it's through blood money. So doctors avoid doing procedures. So let's say, for example, somebody's in a car crash and they develop a punctured lung. The treatment is to put a chest drain in. You know, they may or may not survive, but at least let's give them a chance by putting the drain in and hopefully they'll survive. But in Iraq, doctors will hesitate to put that drain in. They would rather the patient just not give them the chance, let them die. Because if they put the drain in and then the patient dies, the tribes will turn around and say, but you killed the patient.
Right.
So that's where the...
And if they don't like intervene and the patient dies, they won't do that.
They won't do it because then the patient died from the car crash. The doctor didn't do anything. Whereas if the doctor intervened, they will blame the patient. So it's a risk. Do I actually try to save the patient or let them bleed out or whatever it is? So that's what that finding was. But it's interesting, like what another thing that I found was that in any war, the first profession to emigrate out of the war place is our doctors, because they usually have the money and the foresight to be able to leave. And they're the ones that are needed the most, which was quite difficult. So Iraq really had a massive like strain on its healthcare services after the 2003 invasion.
Wow. They probably also have like institutional support, maybe.
From who?
Well, I assume like universities or hospitals.
What universities had to do was they graduated doctors quicker. So instead of it being like, I think it was a 6-year course in Iraq, they reduced it to 5 years just because they needed doctors.
I meant like abroad. They may have some access to.
Oh, not as much. No, yeah. As in into the after 2003, people weren't really like, as in it was Iraq was like a viciously violent place. And especially like 2004 to 2007, like NGOs were like withdrawing as quickly as they could. They were based out of maybe Jordan, Amman. So you didn't really find foreign healthcare workers like coming into Iraq to support, which you might may have found in other wars.
No, I mean in the other way. Sorry, I meant like you could going back to your finding that or the statement that doctors are the quickest to emigrate.
Yeah,
I was just wondering they could also have foreign universities or hospitals maybe can help facilitate that.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. They would take them on. Yeah, because doctors are needed everywhere.
Right. Well, that's interesting. It's kind of changed. I feel like you would not have been able to get that piece in NBC before about, you know, criticizing Israel.
Well, that was only, 2 months ago?
Yeah.
And I feel before I used to struggle if I ever wanted to pitch anything about that may have, like, I guess, criticized Israel. And I do think there's been kind of a trend where criticizing Israel has become more acceptable as people have become more aware of what's happening.
And I
would say Bernie Sanders is someone that's paved that way for a lot of people. Like he was the first presidential the Democratic candidate, to not go to AIPAC, whereas right. in the past everybody else had gone and things like that. And he actually released a statement saying why he wasn't going, and it,
yeah,
and then it criticized Israel.
Amo Bernie.
Yeah, exactly. So there has been a shift, and I think it's important that these discussions are had, and I think it's good that mainstream media is like looking into it as well.
Yeah. What about what's happening in your on your side of the pond? How's Jeremy Corbyn?
So he has been, I guess, shifted out of the Labour Party completely, and he's very much in the fringes, unfortunately. And it's interesting, like he was always from day one having a massive battle. He was painted as this guy who is not leadership material, is not this, is not that. And his own party members were kind of opposed towards him. So sadly, he would never have never worked. And I think the same thing happened with Bernie. Like if you look, he was like, when he was like massively winning in the primaries, the Democratic Party got really worried, and they like made Elizabeth Warren pull out. They made other people pull out and then commit to Joe Biden. So it's just, it's, I guess we're just seeing mirror stories happening from then and here.
Also good on the Israel-Palestine question. Corbyn.
Yeah. So he was painted as this anti-Semite, despite him never saying anything against Jews in his history. But it's kind of a thing where if you do say something about Palestine or you support Palestine, it can be almost political suicide. And AOC realized that before when she'd like had previously used to make comments about against Israel, and then suddenly backtracked and had to change her story about what Israel is. Because it is political suicide. You will get attacked from like both sides, from left and right, when you attack Israel. And it's difficult for people, like if you conflate the story of Israel and anti-Semitism, then you've misinterpreted what politics really is. Like it's not the same. If I complain about Saudi Arabia, it doesn't mean I'm anti-Muslim, kind of thing.
And what do you think, there's obviously a lot of comparisons between Iraq and Afghanistan, but what do you think of what Biden did in Afghanistan, which the media just pounced on him for?
If I'm honest, it was inevitable. I don't think it was a Biden thing. It wasn't like he was the one that did it overnight. This is something that's been happening in stages from Obama through Trump to Biden. And it's just that the last soldier left under Biden. It was inevitable. Like what else did we expect was going to happen? The unfortunate thing is that American soldiers there did commit a lot of crimes whilst they were there. People were dying. One of the examples I mentioned was Kunduz. So it's not like American soldiers there were really fully just purely protecting the Afghans. But then at the same time, we are hearing about these attacks on mosques, on like the sectarian attacks on mosques, which are quite devastating to hear about, which weren't happening under the when the Americans were there. So it's quite a difficult question to answer, the Afghanistan thing. What's the solution? As in, the only real thing that I can talk about is, even discussing Biden isn't for me what the reality is. We should have been discussing what should we have even been there in the first place? Like the story should really start in 2001. Like whenever I look at what's happening today in Afghanistan, I'm not blaming Biden or even Trump or Obama. I'm blaming Bush. Like and I think sometimes that's what the media has missed when they've discussed this. They've blamed Biden for the withdrawal, but not blamed Bush for the entry.
Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think I was pleased that it happened.
Yeah.
And surprised. Yeah. Not that it's not problematic, obviously, and things, you know, there isn't chaos, but I think that it's kind of like the supposition or the suggestion is that, you know, but for our pulling out, things were great there.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Which they weren't. As in anyone who's read any book on Afghanistan or even an article, you'd know that there were massive atrocities happening every day.
Right. Just not of the 13 servicemen.
Yeah.
So people didn't follow it. Thank you so much for coming on. I have one more thing I'm going to do. You can stay. I feel bad because it's so late where you are, but if you want to, no, I'm going to. Yeah. Okay. So you want to, all right. You want to see, I don't know if you've been following this, but I want to share this important update from friend of the show, although he hasn't been on video. He's just been on my podcast a bunch. Adam Johnson, mm-hmm. who does great media criticism work. Have you been on their show? Citations no. Needed. It's really good. No. He co-hosted with Nima Shirazi. So, you know, people may have seen this terrible thing from Breonna Keeler. Terrible, terrible woman. I'm sure she's a lovely woman, but terrible Bernie takes. She basically said, so Bernie did one of those things where he talks about how badly the media reports on something, and he rightly called out the media for not focusing what was in the bill, in the reconciliation infrastructure bills. So just going to read this from the column, which is Adam Johnson's Substack, which is funny because it sounds so right wing to me for some reason, the column, which he's really not, obviously. So he co-wrote a piece with Gabe Levine Drizin. CNN aired horse race coverage 11 times more than Substance. CNN insists it adequately covers the substance of the $3.5 trillion social spending bill. But a survey of three of its major news programs tells a different story. And he shows this clip. It's blame the media clock, and Senator Bernie Sanders is right on time. And so she very defensively says, here, let me play some of this.
Senator Bernie Sanders put out a statement.
Can you guys hear it?
Blaming the media as the main reason for why Americans don't know what's in the Build Back Better plan. He wrote, quote, at the top of the list is the reality that the mainstream media has done an exceptionally poor job in covering what actually is in the legislation. There have been endless stories about the politics of passing Build Back Better, the role of the president, the conflicts in the House and Senate, the opposition of two senators, the size of the bill, and very limited coverage as to what the provisions of the bill are and the crises for working people that they address. Let's take a look at what all he is saying here, because while the media should always be striving to do a better job, it's just not true that the media hasn't covered what is in the bill and doesn't continue to do so. Media outlet after media outlet has covered this, and it's very...
Okay, look, guys, there were headlines saying that they looked at what's in the reconciliation bill.
Easy to find online if you want to know about it. And on television, I mean, just looking at CNN, segment after segment about what is in the bill. In his statement, Sanders refers to how popular the policy provisions in the legislation are when Americans...
Okay, so, all right. That's she thinks that she's refuting Sanders' point by showing that there's some pieces and also CNN stories that go into what's in the bill. But as Adam and Gabe point out, a detailed survey of 12 reconciliation bill segments aired on CNN's major three news programs, The Lead with Jake Tapper, The Situation Room with Wolf Blitzer, and Anderson Cooper 360, reveals that the network covered horse race over Substance 11-1. Of the 2 hours and 6 minutes of total coverage analyzed, only 10 minutes was dedicated to discussing what was actually in the bill, and 1 hour and 55 minutes of airtime was spent on horse race. The column analyzed four segments from each of the three shows and tallied how many total seconds went to discussing what was in the bill versus how many seconds were dedicated to covering the meta or horse race elements of the lawmaking process, sausage making, speculating about how the bill would play in polls, which senator fired back at which senator, how much the bill would cost, quote unquote, taxpayers, quote unquote, and any topic of discussion separate from the content of the bill itself. The details of the survey can be found here, as are the links to the segments for one to watch and see for themselves. The column argued 2 weeks ago that U.S. corporate media was doing a poor job covering the substance of the bill, citing several reports from the previous 24 hours. It wasn't a terribly scientific survey, but meant as a snapshot of one day of coverage at the height of the debate. Obviously, the column doesn't have CNN's resources, but we were able to do a 12-segment survey of CNN's coverage from a high point of the debate, the final 4 days of September. We chose the final 4 days of September because it was the peak of the public debate on the reconciliation bill, and it occurred before Senator Sanders and other progressives began working the refs on coverage, complaining about the hollowness of the public debate. Thus, we feel it's more representative of the point Sanders was making. So that's interesting because, you know, people, they themselves stupidly, Breonna Kaler stupidly, but not surprisingly, points to some of the coverage that they did after Bernie called them out, which really doesn't disprove Bernie Sanders' point. If anything, it proves that it's, you know, useful for him to call them out and take them to task, because then they actually respond to stuff. I'm not going to go down this rabbit hole because people know me. I will spend hours watching anything Bernie related and breaking it down. So just want to give them a shout out for this piece. And yeah, again, it's horse race over substance. No one ever asks how you're going to pay for wars in the media. It's always how you're going to pay for social programs and social spending. So not sure if that happens in England too, but it's how it's done here.
Like, there was that interesting meme I saw recently where it was like something like, oh, Medicare, how are we going to fund that? And then, oh, but military, yeah, sure, here's all my money kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's always the same. Like nobody's ever asked where did the money come from for the Iraq War, but you ask them about any social welfare program, and it's just like, oh no, is there a magic money tree? Is what Theresa May called it?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, Theresa May. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. This was great. I really enjoyed this. Thank you so much. Yeah, of course. Come back on.
Yeah. Let me know.
We'll work something out. You can cover so much stuff. You can be our. We don't have an English correspondent.
We never even spoke about Squid Game.
Oh yeah, Squid Game. Yeah, we'll have to come back. Well, Leslie would kill me if we spoke about Squid Game without you. Should I watch it just so I can take part in the discourse?
You can. I don't think you need. It's a good show. It's a bit overhyped, but it's a good show to watch.
Yeah,
I'm watching Succession though. If anybody wants a good film, a good show to watch.
Oh yeah, you know, I gotta watch them. And I'm gonna try to get. We interviewed Anna McKay on Useful Idiots, so maybe I can try to. We should try to get him back on both shows.
Invite me to that.
I will. Yeah.
That discussion then.
I'll say we've one of the most the big one of my favorite doctors turned filmmaker journalists.
Yeah. Perfect.
Top, you're one of my top five favorite of those who have top met, five, who I've had man. On my show.
I'm honored to be in that top five list.
Yeah. Put that on your website, in your Twitter bio. What kind of medicine did you do?
So what I would do is emergency department, not emergency room.
Oh, okay. So. My dad's a psychiatrist.
Oh, cool. That's we need more of them, basically.
Yeah.
We need more psychiatrists big time.
Where? All over?
All over in general.
Oh, yeah. I agree. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you again so much. Everyone, check out Ahmed's Twitter, his website. And of course, if you want to become supporters of the show, patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on.
Okay. Bye.
Bye, everyone. Thanks again for listening to The Katie Halper Show. If you like the show, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. Our show is produced by me, Katie Halper, Nick Palm. Brad Bloom is our audio engineer and an associate producer on the show. Our researcher is Joshua Bregman. And our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.
If you're a podcast host, listen up. This one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up. This one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.